This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Whose motorcycle is this?
It's a chopper, baby.
Whose chopper is this?
Zed's.
Who's Zed?
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
Must have the precious.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Go ahead. Make my day.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
Hasta la vista, baby. I'll be back.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father. I am your father.
I am Black Widow.
Say hello to my little friend!
And welcome to the Casting Couch here on Joy 94.9. My name is Thomas Caldwell, and panelling and producing is Alan Tuxford. Now, usually Kylie Eddy would be joining me on the couch, but as long-time listeners will know, well, listeners for this year anyway, Kylie works for the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, so she is pretty darn busy with that right now. The good news is my co-host for the show today is Byron Tompkins, one of our regular presenters.
Oh, yes, I love cuddling up next to you on the couch, Thomas.
How are you, Byron?
I'm good, and you?
Good, thank you. Great to have you with us. Now, we're doing another very massive show about the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. We're going to have Maureen's going to pop in and tell us all about Beautiful Darling, a film I'm yet to see and I'm very interested in. Anything to do with Andy Warhol, and I'm all over it usually. Warren's going to come in again to talk about some of the documentary films that are showing throughout the festival. And in the second hour, and you're going to want to listen to this, we're going to be interviewing the Brazilian director and writer of From Beginning to End. His name is Lúcio Abrantes. And for those of you who have been following the progress of this film in the Melbourne Queer Film Festival program, you're going to know it's very controversial. It's about brothers who don't just love each other, they love each other.
Exactly.
Now, we're going to look at a couple of regular release films as well, out on general release. So we're going to talk about the new Kevin Smith film, Cop Out, and the latest film by Irish director Jim Sheridan, Brothers, which is a remake of a 2004 Danish film. Now, Byron, before we go any further, Melbourne Queer Film Festival kicked off on Wednesday night.
It did indeed.
You were there with Alan.
I was, yeah. Yes. Quite a big shindig down at the Astor there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good night. The film was quite interesting. I must admit, I unfortunately missed Alan's review last week. But, yeah, my take on it was kind of a Korean film trying to be a gay French film with a little bit of The Ring or The Host thrown in for supernatural added effect.
That'll do. Yeah. I reckon that kind of sums it up. Well, it's a real genre mash, which is what's happening a lot in South Korean cinema at the moment. And how was the after party and the after party? Did you get to that one?
Yes, I did. No, it was a good night.
What can you remember?
No. There was a flash mob. I heard the flash mob. I didn't actually see them. So I think Alan and I were looking for some YouTube footage. So if anyone's got footage and haven't put it up to YouTube, put it up for those of us that missed it.
Yeah, I'd like to check that out as well. Yeah. I think on the MQFF website they're starting to put stuff up. I'm not 100% sure about that, but that's as good a place as any to start.
Yeah,
so it was a good night, good-sized crowd. And
it was probably a bit down on last year's sizes, but I think that was... I heard somewhere that people were complaining about the after-party being too packed last year, so it was a bit more manageable this year. There was room to swing the proverbial cat.
Bit more crowd control, yeah. Oh, it sounds great. I think it's good that it's kind of brave actually doing a foreign language film as the opening night film, because some people are funny. They get put off by subtitles. Yes. I just think, honestly, I can't have any respect for you if you don't see films because they have subtitles. It's just dumb.
Yeah, no, and I must admit now, my other half, Josh, now turns around when we're going to the movies and he goes, do I need to bring my reading glasses? And I'll be like, yes.
Well, that's different. That, I mean, I do acknowledge there are some people where it's quite difficult to read the titles. Yeah. Did he enjoy it?
Yeah, he did. Same. I think all round we thought it was odd, but it worked because it was odd.
Yeah. Oh, well, as Ellen and I were saying last week, it was a really good opening night film because it has a kind of wacky, crazy, festive atmosphere to it.
Yeah, no, definitely, I would agree.
Fantastic. Well, the festival's in full swing. Now, one of the films that's going to be on at the festival is The Big Gay Musical. That's going to be on Friday the 27th of March, 6:15 at the Acme Cinemas, and we've got a double pass for that. Now, we're not going to give it away right now at some point during the show, or just a call out for people to ring in to try and claim that double pass then. So you're just going to have to listen to us for the full 2 hours until we do that. Now, Byron, usually yes. I am sort of hair dictator with the music, but I would love to hear what other people on the show listen to and would program for the show. So I'm going to hand over to you today.
Fabulous. Because I've...
You've put together a playlist?
I've put together a bit of a playlist. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of 80s in there as well as some more slightly recent ones.
Mm-hmm.
But we're actually going to kick off with It's the End of the World as We Know It by REM.
Fantastic. You're on the Casting Couch. This is Joy 94.9. You're on the Casting Couch, enjoy 94.9 with Thomas and Byron. What did we just listen to, Byron?
Okay, the first song up we had It's the End of the World as We Know It from REM, and that was, of course, from ID4 or Independence Day, depending on what name you knew the film by.
Excellent.
And the song we've just heard was a song called Intense by a group, Alicia's Attic, and that was in Starship Troopers.
I can see a theme developing here already.
Oh, a little bit.
Yeah, no, hey, you're never going to get a complaint from me about the use of science fiction.
Fabulous.
On the show. I love it. Let's talk about Brothers. This is a new film by Jim Sheridan. He's an Irish director who did films such as In America, In the Name of the Father and My Left Foot. And he's now working, obviously, in Hollywood. And this new film of his is a remake of a fairly acclaimed 2004 Danish film, which is also called Brothers, by a director named Susanne Bier. Now, I've seen the original... And I believe you have not.
I've not, no.
No. Well, this will be a good conversation because I think we're going to come to it at from different perspectives. The first thing is it's a really faithful remake. It's almost an identical story. So there's three main characters, basically. You've got the two brothers. One in this new film is played by Tobey Maguire. He's the good all-American kid. He's a war hero, a really moral, righteous man who works in Iraq in the army. Not in Iraq, sorry.
Afghanistan.
Yep. So he's fighting the Taliban. Then there is his wife, who is played by Natalie Portman. They're childhood sweethearts. It's a really strong, stable relationship. They've got two daughters. Then there's his brother, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who has just gotten out of prison. And, yeah, he's your black sheep of the family.
Yep.
So it's a dynamic between these three, and... It's the kind of film where I don't really want to talk too much about the plot because I guess probably the less you know, the better. But I think it's enough to say it's a film about post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes.
So it's about people going to war and coming back with some incredible baggage and how that affects their domestic life. And also it's a film about, I think, jealousy. And I read somewhere it's loosely based on Homer's The Odyssey.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but
yes.
A big part of that is the whole thing about Odysseus going off to war and then people trying to hit on his wife.
Yep.
When they think he's gone. That dynamic happens in this film. This issue of what happens to a desirable woman when her husband, we don't know what's happened to him.
Yes.
So it's this fairly strong drama. What did you think?
Yeah, I am... To be honest, if I was to say, oh, I'm going to go and choose a film, it's not the sort of film I would choose to go and see.
Mm.
But I must admit I was surprised by it. I found it a bit... Tobey Maguire, I found him a bit... It took me a while to get over the fact that he's Peter Parker.
Yeah, he looks really young, doesn't he?
He looks really young, yeah. And even the sort of the vague Peter Parker stares off into the distance sort of come out a bit.
But for our non-nerd listeners, let's just qualify, we're talking about Spider-Man.
Yes.
It's okay for you and I. Yes.
But I must admit, it took him a while to get there, but I became convinced... of Sam Cahill towards the end of the film,
mm-hmm.
when he's basically going off his nut, and that was just something totally different, something I've never seen from Tobey Maguire before, and yeah, it impressed me.
I'm with you, actually. Just you mentioning that scene, well, the scene that you're alluding to is probably the same scene I'm thinking of. I actually just got a small shiver.
Yeah.
Because he does an amazing performance in this, this very climactic scene, and it's probably the best thing he's done on camera.
Yeah.
I think you're right. It takes us a while to... to be endeared towards the character. We like him, but in the sense of finding him believable. But by the end of the film, damn, he's acted his pants off, hasn't he?
Yes. Yeah, no. It takes a while, but he nails it in the end.
Yeah. Now, I've got to say, I think the original film does it better because you have a slightly old actor, an actor who's not so conventionally good-looking, and an actor who I'd never seen before either. So I think that character has more power in the original film, and that the original film gives us more time to get to know him and to see him with his family, where I think the big difference between these two films is that this new one, this American one, is a little bit more literal and obvious, and they spell stuff out for you more. Not necessarily a bad thing, though.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, it actually helps you to work through some of the character dynamic a little bit, but it loses some of the nuances.
Yeah. Question for you, the original film, is it set in Denmark or is it Americanized?
Yeah. No, it's set in Denmark, and again, it's about this guy who goes to, he's a soldier in Afghanistan and the repercussions of what happens to him on a particular mission. Yeah. I also think, again, I love all these actors. I mean, these are three of my favourite actors at the moment. But again, Jake Gyllenhaal's character in this film, we become sympathetic to him, I think, far too easily. Where in the original film, he's a lot rougher and he has to work harder for us to like him. Where Jake Gyllenhaal is a good-looking guy, he's got charisma.
Yeah.
It's almost a little bit too easy to like him.
Yeah, no, true. One of the kids... I'm trying to think if it was Isabel or...
You're talking about the two children, the Tobey Maguire and Natalie Portman character have together? Yep.
One of the kids, when the way... I was impressed with her as well, just like when she seemed scared, upset and angry, you could see it on her face. You could almost feel what she was feeling.
What I loved about both kids, actually, is they did that thing that kids do where they try to put on a brave face and act like everything's okay. But you can see that their poor little hearts are falling to pieces.
Yeah.
And that kind of trembling lip and that emotion was really powerful. And I agree. I think the kids in this film do an amazing job. In fact, even though this is a film called Brothers and the dynamic between the two brothers is really important, I think the secret to this film is the two kids and the Natalie Portman character.
Yes.
Who is sort of the common element. And again, I think Portman in this film, astonishing.
Yeah.
And she's probably the best cast, actually, because it is a character who's meant to be attractive and desired and yet strong. And I think Natalie Portman is, boy, she's evolved just... From, you know, that
Princess
Luke Besson.
Princess Amidala.
Amidala, yeah. And, you know, when she was the child actor in The Professional.
Yes.
She has just become such a strong and formidable actor, and I really liked her in this film.
Yeah, and she's starting to really tackle these more gritty roles as well. Like, she's done the Imaginarium or whatever it was, or the real sort of fluffy roles or the fantasy roles, where now she's getting right down into sort of the nitty-gritty realities of life, and in this film, the realities of being an army wife.
Yeah. Look, if I hadn't seen the original film, I think I would have been really blown away by this. It's hard, actually, when you have that baggage. I've got to tell you, though, as remakes go, it's one of the better ones. I would say to people, it's really worth your while getting hold of the 2004 Danish film Brothers.
Okay.
But nevertheless, this is still really good cinema, and I think people should check this out. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars.
Yeah, I'm there with you. I'm giving it 3.5 as well.
Excellent. So that's Brothers, which is playing sort of mediumly. It's not wide. It's not a wide release. It's not a small release. It's a medium release.
Yeah, it's more sort of the your local cinema, their special little section off the side seems to have it, yeah.
And the arty boutique chains, yeah. Okay, you're listening to Thomas and Byron here on Joy 94.9. We're going to have Maureen next to talk about Beautiful Darling, which is playing at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. Music. Byron, yes. What are we about to listen to?
We're going back to the 80s for a bit of Duran Duran, the song Notorious, which you may all remember from Donnie Darko.
Good call. I love it. You're on Joy 94.9. Not, not, no time. You're back on the Carson Couch with Thomas and Byron here on Joy 94.9. Hey, we just heard an announcement there all about the big gay musical. We've got a double pass on the show that we're going to give away a bit later, so keep listening for that. But now we have Maureen in the studio with us. Hi.
Hiya there.
Thank you for joining us yet again.
Pleasure.
Now, you've been doing more MQFFing.
Yes.
McQuiffing.
Yes.
Doesn't work, does it? You've gone to see a film I'm really, really interested to hear all about, and I think the impression we got last week is that quite a few of our listeners want to find out more as well. This is a film called Beautiful Darling. It's a documentary all about Candy Darling, who I gather was part of the whole Andy Warhol thing.
Yes. Beautiful Darling, the life and times of Candy Darling, Andy Warhol superstar. Apparently Andy Warhol had a few different superstars in his time.
Yep.
So Candy Darling was born James Slattery but moved to New York and became known as Candy Darling there. And she's been immortalised in a few different genres. She was in a couple of Warhol's films. But and she's also the Candy that's mentioned in Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side.
Ah.
Yeah.
Ah.
And also the Velvet Underground song Candy Says.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I knew that one.
There's a lot of photographs of her, and she was photographed by Robert Mapplethorpe and Cecil Beaton, and there's also a photo by Peter Huger, who I didn't actually know who he was, but it's Candy Darling on her deathbed, and it's an amazing photograph, and it's also been used on album covers. So she's shown in a lot of different sort of songs and films. She and in this actual documentary, it's got old interviews and new interviews, so interviews with people who were around at the time sharing the factory scene with her. There's even a couple of snippets from John Waters in there and Penny Arcade, but a lot of like other Warhol associates, like his assistant Gerard Malanga, and then other people like Holly Woodlawn.
Mm-hmm. Were they able to get people like Lou Reed? Or
no, he doesn't. I think there's a bit of footage of him because it has a lot of old film footage, like the Andy Warhol films that she was in.
Yes.
But also they obviously, were always sort of recording themselves
That was part of the Warhol thing,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was just to constantly preserve the image and turn things into products. I mean, Warhol loved that idea of the superstar, the product, the marketable thing and the reproduction of image. And it sounded like Candy Darling was very much part of that.
Yeah, although, I mean, I think Candy was all for doing that herself. I think she'd already started that before she, even hooked up with Andy Warhol.
Oh, okay.
They have, I think it's actually Chloe Savini who's reading the diary entries from Candy's diaries.
Yep.
And so they're actually really useful or important because they're very revealing about, like, they're from Candy, like, talking about what she was like as a young person and then why she wanted to sort of reinvent herself and create this whole persona. She modelled herself, I think, at least on Kim Novak, at least partly. Uh-huh. So that was one of the interesting things that's pointed out by, a couple of the interviewees in the film, is that she was actually kind of modelling herself on kind of past people, like not what was really very contemporary at the time.
So she was doing retro before retro was even a thing that people did.
Yes. But the other, she's an amazing looking woman. I mean, like, she was very kind of finely sculpted face. So, like, it's just, as I say, there are a lot of photographs sort of shown in this documentary at all, but it's not at all boring, like, looking at these photographs, because she's just so kind of riveting.
And it sounds like, from what you're saying, the documentary makes sure that we see all the many different sides and styles of her. And
that's right. And because the other interesting thing it does is it actually has this a person in there called Jeremiah Newton who knew her from when he was a young guy who met her on sort of the streets, I think, of New York. And, he's obviously an older man now, but he's the executor of her estate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's also sort of kind of quite revealing about him as well. And part of the documentary is sort of covering what he actually has her ashes, and he's sort of wanting to make sure that they're suitably kind of interred. So it's kind of got all these different levels to the documentary, as well as raising all this stuff about what you kind of mentioned early on about with Andy Warhol and the whole celebrity scene.
Yep.
And you know, what seems to happen is sometimes these people get championed for a while and then they can be unceremoniously dumped.
So Warhol was a bit ruthless about
I wish someone else had seen it, because it seems to be like he made a couple of films with her and then he didn't cast her in his next film. I mean, they do talk...
Because she was in Flesh, which was one of the big Warhol films.
Yeah, yep. And Women in Revolt. There's so many things in this documentary, because they're also talking about, you know, what she did for feminism, like, you know, this thing of sort of being this, what you referred to as a retro kind of female that, you know, like apparently some of the feminists hated her, you know, for the sort of woman that she was portraying. So,
yeah, I was curious about that because...
Yeah, look, I mean, they interview Fran Lebowitz in there. I mean, she seemed to be, I think, fairly liked. Even that's one of the other funny things about the documentary, is because they'll interview one person and one of them will say something about Candy, and then the next person they interview says something in complete contradiction of what's just been said. So,
which helps add to the myth.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm not sure whether I've come away like really certain of what these people were like,
but the stories are in there and they're great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like what Tony Wilson says in 24-Hour Party People, when you've got a choice between printing the truth and the legend, print the legend.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but there's some pathos in there as well, because as I said, from the diary entries, you can see that she was still struggling with, you know, loneliness and just not being very happy. So,
and she died very young.
Yes, yes.
30 years old. I'm just looking up her details now. She died.
Yeah,
so that's very sad.
Yes. Mm. So the director actually talks about whether, because she was, using female hormones and buying them on the streets of New York and stuff, and whether, that contributed to the death. But apparently in, she was even sort of, they say in the movie, playing a role on her deathbed, that, you know, she was still had this persona
still
going.
Performing.
So, yeah, it's a really interesting documentary.
It sounds absolutely fascinating. What can you give it a star rating for us?
Yeah, I'll give it 3.5 stars.
3.5 stars. Yeah, that's a strong endorsement. So this is Beautiful Darling, The Life and Times of Candy Darling, Andy Warhol, Superstar. It's part of the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. It's playing Sunday, the 28th of March, of course, at 2:30 at Acme, like all the other films. So go to acme.org. No, go to mqff.com.au to find details about that. Thanks, Maureen.
Pleasure.
You're going to come back next week.
Yeah.
To actually co-host with Byron.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah, neither Kylie nor I can do the show, so you two will be in charge. I'm looking forward to hearing. I won't be able to listen to it at the time, but I'm looking forward to hearing later how things go down.
It'll be fine.
For more MQFF action as well, you guys have got a terrific interview next week. I'm very jealous. You're on the Casting Couch with Byron and Thomas. This is Joy 94.9. I've changed my mind. You're back on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Byron here on Joy 94.9. Byron, what did we listen to then?
We just heard Erase Rewind by the Cardigans from the sci-fi flick The 13th Floor.
I've never seen that. A lot of people tell me I should check it out.
You should. I think you would enjoy it.
Nice one. All right, we're now joined in the studio by Warren, who... G'day, Warren. How are you going?
Hi, Thomas. Hi, Byron.
Now, you've been our admin support for all of this year, and now we're getting you in front of the mic. This is my second time.
Last week I talked about documentaries on and short films on as part of the Queer Film Festival, and tonight I'm talking about a longer documentary, a 60-minute documentary called Not So Straight. It's on as part of the Queries 3 program in the film festival.
Yeah, well, this film in fact is the entirety of the Kiwis.
There's a lot of us around.
Yeah, I know. A room full of sort of Kiwis and
New Zealanders.
honorary ones.
Honorary one like that. Tell us all about Not So Straight.
Okay, well, it's really about the YAC program, and the YAC program is run by Family Planning Victoria. It's for same gender young people with gender identification problems. So it's ultimately about acceptance, accepting oneself, accepting each other in the group, and acceptance by other people. Jenny O'Keefe, who's a former broadcaster on Joy, and Micah Scott from...
Casting Couch presenter too. Yeah.
From Generation Next. They're involved as interviewers and spokespeople during the documentary.
Okay.
As I said, Family Planning Victoria, it's their program. It runs every a couple of Fridays a month in Melbourne CBD. I wondered who their target audience was, and I concluded it would be same-sex attracted young people and those who support those people. So perhaps their parents, uncles, cousins, siblings, they would be the core audience. And it's screening, that's tomorrow at 12 o'clock at ACME.
Okay, so what is the film actually about? What is it, a documentary? Is it a...
Well, it has 9 chapters, as they call them.
Yeah.
So after they set it up in an introduction, there's a chapter about sexual identity. So basically it's a cast, if you like, sitting around. They've obviously been quite facilitated, so they're comfortable talking on camera about things they've talked about with each other. But having said that, it's not overly rehearsed. So they talk about the theme, if you like, but they don't tell you what the theme is. They just talk about themselves. And you realise, oh, well, this is the chapter about sexual identity or going out or virtual spaces or HIV or relationships. So there's all these different chapters, and they're quite separate. And I think there's a logic behind that, so that they can be shown in schools. So they can show a chapter and talk about the chapter and get young people to talk about, well, homophobia, how do we react to it, what can we do about it, how do we overcome it, you know, that sort of thing. So that's how – that's the fact that it's not just one big narrative. It's this – people who get together, have a talk about a thing straight to camera, and you get to find their stories in there as it goes along.
Oh, okay, so it sounds like it's a film with a very practical purpose. It's not simply there to entertain or even to inform. It has a purpose beyond that, to be used as a teaching aid. And
I think so. I think it raises the question, how can video be used as an agent for social change?
Okay.
And that's really what I think. This video and its premiere tomorrow at ACME as part of the film festival is really pointing to a bigger story of how do you make a film like this, because it needs a lot of resources and the time and commitment of the producers, and then what happens after you've made it? You know, does it start other conversations? So I did a bit of reading about Mark Camilleri, who's a facilitator with Family Planning Victoria. So FPV recognised that same-sex attracted people are often limited in their opportunities to meet other young people. And you've got to bear in mind that when you're under 18, you're not supposed to go into a licensed club. So what do? You go and hang out with people? Is it no alcohol, therefore no dance clubs? I'm not sure about that, but anyway. So Mark says that people who are isolated are perhaps starting to question who they are. This is what happens in adolescence. Yeah, naturally.
Yeah, exactly.
And so he's hoping that people will see the documentary Not So Straight, and they will say, this is my community. These people are just like me. And this is how they found their space in the world, how they found their space in the world and the community, including the GLBTI community. So watching the documentary, you get that sense. These people are quite diverse. There's a young woman who's bisexual. She gets pregnant at some stage between the beginning of the filming and the end of it. So at the end, you see a baby and you go, hurry on. But she's got the baby there, and she's facing being a solo mum with not much money, perhaps homeless at different stages. And her peer group are other people who are part of the YAC program.
Okay.
So that's quite touching. But it's not the major thing in there. The major thing is people are diverse, and they deserve to be respected and respect each other.
And it's a celebration of that diversity. And it sounds like what it's doing is it's presenting itself to people who may be struggling with some of these things and these identity things and maybe feeling ostracised, and saying, we are all in this together.
Yeah,
There's a lot of people out there like you.
These are quite natural things to face as you grow up. But if you've got some people to sit around and have a chat with and say, yeah, I feel like that sometimes. And you know, relationships with my partner, whatever gender, being the girl or boy I want to be, getting on with my parents, those are all difficult things.
Yeah. Okay, nice one. So that's going to be screening tomorrow, did you say, at midday?
That's right.
ACME. Actually, it looks like it's sold out online, but there are standby tickets available. So,
and there's a question and answer session after with the filmmaker and some of the cast members.
Okay, so we'll put the link up to the MQFF page for that on the Facebook site, and I'll also link to Family Planning Victoria, because you were telling me off air, Warren, that they're obviously a very important part of this film.
Along with the City of Melbourne. So a couple of locations are the Melbourne Aquarium, so you've got all these fish swimming around in the background, providing colour and movement, and you've got the hands, which are recognised as part of the logo from the multicultural hub up near Vic Market.
Okay.
It's two spaces.
Now, quickly, we've got about a couple of minutes left. You've seen some of the other docos that are going to be screening here and there. Do you want to quickly comment on anything else?
Yes, screening tomorrow at 2 o'clock and then again next Sunday the 28th at 12:30 at ACME as part of the film festival, the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. AusDocs program. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of longer documentaries that go for almost half an hour. One is Gorgeous Vonnie, which is a Channel 31 production by Ms. I'm a Star and The Bear. Their program is Beauty and the Bear. It's on Channel 31. Mm-hmm. Basically, this is this video is straight as an episode of that program with a few bits on the end, which is to do with Barbie doll collecting, if I remember rightly. The other longer documentary is part of AusDocs for the Queer Film Festival is Life is Elsewhere. Mm-hmm. This is about twin sisters, Amy and Claire, and they're from Hobart. And, in Hobart, the synagogue is opposite a club called Crew's. So Amy talks about, well, this is my space, making art about being Jewish and in Hobart. So there's those two, and a documentary about a musician called Jess McAvoy, one called Daryl, about a complex, tough bastard who talks about love and compassion.
Yep.
And then there's finally, as part of the other AusDocs program, is The Rise of Leatherman, which has got some really cheesy music and a man who's just on a mission to love himself and enjoy life.
As we all should. That sounds great. You're going to be back next week when Byron and Maureen are hosting the show, and you're going to talk further about the Oz documentary program then.
That's right.
Yeah, fantastic. Warren, thank you very, very much for that. Folks, keep listening. We've got plenty more coming up in the second hour, including an interview with the director of From Beginning to End, and we'll also give away that double pass to the Big Gay Musical, which is happening Friday the 27th of March, 6:15 at ACME. Thanks to our buddies at MQFF for that. Byron, let's have some music that takes us up to the news. What have you got for us?
I've lined up My Nutmeg Fantasy by Macy Gray, and it's from Spider-Man.
Fantastic. You're listening to The Casting Couch on Joy 94.9. We're back on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Byron. Now, Byron, we're going to talk about a film that we saw.
Yes.
Well, it wasn't a date, but we were together. We went to see...
With our respective others.
We were there with our respective others. We went to see Cop Out, which is the new film by Kevin Smith. Now, to bring people up to speed, Kevin Smith, of course, was one of the indie darlings from the early 90s with Clerks. He did Mallrats. Chasing Amy was sort of his sort of more respectable breakthrough hit. Recently, he's done things like Clerks 2 and Zack and Miri Make a Porno. Now, this is the first... Kevin Smith is known for his writing. He kind of has this juvenile writing style with his kind of empathy and a very wicked sense of humour. He's known for writing really good dialogue that's often filthy but very funny. He's not known for his direction. He does direct all his films, but they're often very flat. Now, the weird thing about Cop Out is he hasn't written it. It's been written by somebody else, and they've brought him on to direct, and directing is really not his forte. Now, Cop Out does feel like the film, though, that he may have written himself. It kind of is lowbrow, filthy humour, and it's a real homage to 80s cop films. In fact, the very first scene in this film has there's a piece of dialogue where the two main characters, Jimmy Munro, played by Bruce Willis, and then Paul Hodges, who is played by Tracy Morgan of 30 Rock fame. They talk about 80s cop film homages, and it kind of cues you into the fact that I think this film is partly a loving parody and partly wanting it to be an 80s cop film. I mean, what did you think, Byron? Because I actually struggled with this film to figure out whether, at points, are we meant to take this seriously or is it taking the piss?
Yeah, no, I can see where you're coming from there. It was one of those films where you laugh at something and you sit there going, I can't believe I'm laughing at this.
I think
there was times where I was laughing going, why am I laughing? And there was other times when other people in the cinema laughed and I thought, how can they laugh at this?
Yeah, who are these people? they vote? Yes. No, I know what you mean. I mean, yeah, so just throw back to things like Beverly Hills Cop and 48 Hours and Lethal Weapon. I found out that, you know, it's got really cheesy electronic music. It's the same guy who composed the music for Beverly Hills Cop. So that's done deliberately. It's overacted. There's really over-the-top stereotypical Mexican drug lord villains. And at one point, I thought I should be offended by this representation. I thought I couldn't be bothered. It's just so kind of irrelevant. I hope that he's taking the piss. I mean, the plot is completely thin. I mean, I'm not even too sure really what it was about. There's these two cops, so your classic kind of bad guy. Hang on. They're the goodies, but they're the mavericks. They do things wrong, they screw up, and they're on a quest to recover a stolen baseball card.
The plot could have been so much better. With a different acting style and different scripting, the plot could actually be quite a good film. Like, maybe not have a baseball card, but have something else. Mm. But it had the potential to be a really good film, but it just didn't quite make it there. And, like, Paul Hodges character doing the constant baby talk.
Tracy Morgan. He's annoying, isn't he?
Oh, it was doing my head in.
Yeah. See, I think Tracy Morgan's very good in 30 Rock because you've got a strong writer like Tina Fey giving him lines, where in this film, apparently Kevin Smith just said, oh, you're great, go and do your thing. And all he does is shout, just those shouty kind of diatribes he does, and you can't even understand what he says a lot. He's not very good at articulating. And Bruce Willis just walks around looking bemused. You know, slap him and say, Bruce, I know you can do some good stuff.
Yeah,
come on, pull the finger out.
I found myself sitting there thinking, why does someone like Bruce Willis actually say, yes, I'm going to do this? Well, like, does part of his brain actually really enjoy that, or is he really that hard up for cash?
Yeah, or he just thinks it could be fun. I don't know. I don't know. It's funny what you said earlier about how you would laugh at this film and points, and then think, oh, God, why am I laughing? Because there were aspects of this that I found really funny, but I think I was just desperately trying to find something to grasp onto. I mean, the scene where I really cacked up was a scene with an 11-year-old car thief.
Yes.
And basically the gag was, it's this kid who swears a lot, talks about my business, and then punches someone in the balls.
Mm.
And the fact that I found that really, really funny shows how desperate I think I was to find anything amuse me. Because, I mean, honestly, people getting punched in the ball gags, I mean, come on.
Yeah, and there was a dialogue in the film to do with the taser and Sean William Scott and the turtle head and the tongue poking out. It's like, that snuck up on me 3 days later, sitting in the middle of a meeting where all of a sudden, out of the blue, I cracked up laughing and everyone just turned around and stared at me. I'm like, oh, sorry.
Oh, so this film has had an impact on your life, then.
But not a positive one, that's for sure.
Now, you mentioned Sean William Scott, because actually I think he's one of the better things about this film. He's the guy who we all know as Stifler.
Yes.
And he is just obviously making a career now playing that kind of lovable, smart-ass character.
Or Dude, Where's My Car?
And Dude, Where's My Car? Yes. I've got a soft spot for him.
Oh, look, so do
I. I think he's funny.
I do like him in Dude, Where's My Car? And, like, I have so many sort of people that look at me and go, how can you like that film?
No, Dude, Where's My Car is it's a bit of a classic.
It is.
Yeah. If you're in the right state of mind, very fun, that film. He did give me a few laughs in this film. Look, the thing is, when you're going to do a homage to a group of films or even a loving parody, you need to have a combination of knowing the genre, being able to reproduce it, and then doing something kind of fresh and interesting with it. Now, I think Kevin Smith has done 2 out of 3 things here, because there's nothing fresh or interesting about this film. Think of Hot Fuzz. That got it right.
Yes.
That was slightly taking the piss and slightly loving it for what it was, and it was original and really, really funny. I think Cop Out wants to be an American Hot Fuzz, and it falls so far short.
Yeah, and it's like there was that other, there was the other British series, which was, it was like all these highbrow British housewives who are actually like a drug cartel and suburban shootout murder, something or other. It's done the same sort of thing.
Oh, I don't know that.
I'll have to dig that one up for you.
Scream and Shaun of the Dead are examples of how this works with the horror films.
Yeah.
But no, Cop Out just does not work. Okay, I'm going to give it a star rating. I did get a few laughs out of it.
Yeah.
So I feel I should give it at least a 2.
Yeah, I was going to say I give it 2 turtle heads.
2 turtle heads, and you'll have to see the film to get that reference.
Yes.
It's really gross. Byron, oh, it looks like your next track is called Full Moon. That's yes. very appropriate.
from turtle heads to full moons, yes. The song is Full Moon, and it's by, I've lost my place, it's by the Black Ghost, that's right, and it's from the Twilight film, the first one.
Nice one. You're on the Casting Couch with Byron and Thomas on Joy 94.9. When the full moon. You're back on the Casting Couch here on Joy 94.9 with Thomas and Byron. Hey, if you haven't found our Facebook page yet, why don't you jump onto Facebook, do a search for the Casting Couch and become a fan. It's a good way to interact with us during the show, and that's where we log all our reviews as well, so you can see what we're doing live and, you know, you get a record of how we've reviewed everything. Also, shameless self-promotion time, you can read more of my work at blog.cinemaautopsy.com. That's a website that has the last 10 years of my writing on film, really. So there's lots of stuff there, and I also use that to put up the playlists and to announce what's coming up later on the show. Podcasting is something you can do with us as well at joy.org.au/podcast. Now, Nick, who normally does our podcasting, is away for a couple of weeks. So for the next 2 weeks, there won't be any. But when he does get back, he's going to put everything up. So there will be a full archive of all the MQFF shows, which is all very good. Now, Byron, I've just been flicking through. We can't cover everything of the film festival. I reckon what we're just scratching the surface with our coverage.
Yep.
I've been flicking through the program, and I thought I should just give a shout-out to some of the sessions that I am really dying to see and interested in myself, in case you share my views. Little Ashes. This is a film by Paul Morrison that stars Twilight Robert Pattinson. He's playing Salvador Dali. Now, apparently this film was made before the Twilight films and before Remember Me, which Kylie and I talked about last week. And frankly, I've become increasingly obsessed and fascinated with Robert Pattinson. I'm just going to acknowledge that on air. I don't know why. He shits me. But there is something about this guy who's being this manufactured icon to sort of, I don't know, he's like a poor man's James Franco, trying to do that kind of James Dean thing. But I'm fascinated by it. Maybe it's the Warhol aspect of me who's so fascinated by the image that this guy is projecting.
So I wasn't imagining things when I walked in and thought, oh my gosh, you've got an Edward Cullen fringe today.
Exactly. I want to be him. I also wanted to mention a film called Telstar, which is written by Dunstan Black. He's the guy who won the Academy Award for Milk. And it's the apparently stranger than fiction story about a gay maverick songwriter-producer called Joe Meek, who was making music in the early 60s. Kevin Spacey has a small role in this film, apparently, and I'm just keen to track down anything else that Dunstan Black has been involved with, because yeah, I thought definitely. Milk was so incredibly strong. And finally, I wanted to mention the documentary Outrage by Kirby Dick. Mark and I, when we did the show last year during the Melbourne International Film Festival, mentioned this film Outrage.
Yep.
We reviewed it then, but it's showing again at MQFF. This is all about American senators who are opposed to gay rights, who are themselves in the closet.
Yes.
Do you remember where
yes,
we spoke
yes,
about
I
that?
Do
it's
remember
the ultimate
the
in self-loathing
yeah.
members of the GLBTI community, and it's a really provocative documentary.
Because there's another one that's just been in the news recently in America because he's just recently...
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I can't remember who it was.
It's a minefield of issues.
McKinsey someone, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's an absolute minefield of issues. And,
yeah.
and this documentary, Outrage, really explores the issues in their full depth. So be good if you can check that one out. Okay, coming up soon, we're going to be interviewing Luzio Abrantes, the director of From Beginning to End. But let's do the giveaway. Let's do the giveaway, courtesy of our friends at MQFF, for a double pass to The Big Gay Musical. Now, that is going to be on Friday the 27th of March, 6:15 PM at Acme, also known as 6:15 PM. That pass has come to us courtesy of MQFF. You do need to be a Joy member or willing to join up on the spot, and you can't have won anything over the past 2 weeks. So look, get in touch with us now. We'll take calls on 1300-JOY-949. We'll take SMSs on 0427-JOY-949, and we'll take emails on air at joy.org.au. we'll just take, you know, entries via all those means over the next 10 minutes, and then later in the show, we'll just pick one at random and we'll let you know who won on air. You're listening to The Carson Couch on Joy 94.9. Byron, you've got some more music for us, so take us out.
Yes, we're going to have a listen to Ooh La La by Deborah Popping from The X-Files, I Want to Believe.
Fantastic. Let's go with it. You are indeed back on The Carson Couch with Thomas and Byron. The latest film by Brazilian director Aluzio Abranches is one of the most anticipated films screening at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. From beginning to end has already created a lot of controversy in Brazil, with its tale of two brothers whose intimacy and love for each other becomes sexual. We are very pleased to now have Aluzio Abranches, the writer and director of From Beginning to End, here in the Joy Studios with us. Aluzio, welcome to The Casting Couch.
Thank you.
I hope I'm not butchering your name too much.
It's Aluizio.
Oh, Aluizio. I was way off.
That was very close.
Aluizio. Okay. Now, this film has very provocative subject matter. You depict an incestuous relationship between a pair of brothers. What made you want to depict that? What aspect of this relationship was of interest to you?
According to my shrink, technically it's not incest because they can't procreate, but you know, that's just a joke.
yeah, I haven't heard that one before.
No, he said that.
Really?
Yeah. And the thing is that I thought it was a strong way of talking about, you know, both subjects, incest and homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to treat both these issues and both these subjects in a very sort of, you know, natural way. I mean, nowadays, I mean, homosexuality in a different way, that's very old, you know. I mean, nobody can have any prejudice with homosexuality. You don't need to, you know, to first convince anybody that it's completely normal to be a homosexual. It's like, it's a sexual preference, it's sexual preference, you're not offending anybody. So I wanted, and I thought it would be stronger if I made it in, you know, this love story between brothers, and it would be more, you know, the theme of incest attracted me from my, you know, not childhood, but my adolescent. I read a couple of books that treated the subject. There's a very good book written by S.H. Queiroz. It's a Portuguese writer called Os Maias that treated about, you know, incest between a brother and a sister. And it doesn't end very well, the novel. I read it a few times, and I always wanted to change the end. So I thought it would be a stronger way of talking about both subjects, making them, you know, like two men and making them brothers. But the film is about love. It's not about homosexuality or about incest. It's about love.
Sure. Well, one thing I was curious to talk to you about, though, just going back to the incest issue. I know it's more than that. It is about love. But what, and I think this says a lot about the cultural differences, perhaps, about your country and our country, is that there are still some very conservative attitudes in Australia. And not that long ago, we had a very conservative politician who said something that implied there was a link between being homosexual and incest. That if you're, the way he made a particular expression was to suggest that one follows on from the other. He connected them in this statement, which was a really horrible thing to say, and he was rightly condemned for it. But I think that's my concern, is that we don't want to link homosexuality and incest together because they're quite different things.
Well, no, but the film doesn't say, I mean, that you should be brothers to be allowed to be homosexual or vice versa. Yep. It doesn't say that. It's just a story that it just happened. You know, there is a something of fate in the story as well. You know, it happened. Mm-hmm. But the film doesn't say this is, you know, this is good, or it doesn't. It's not a judgmental story or a judgmental film. It doesn't treat it like that, you know.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask. There are no moral statements in this film.
No moral statements.
You're not judging your characters, no. Which is a filmmaker. You, of course, you cannot do that if you're going to make a credible film. So that must have been part of your intention to not do that.
In that subject, maybe in other subjects you can. I mean, if you're talking about a crime, you know, murder, or if you're treating other subjects, maybe you can be judgmental. But talking about love, you know, and it's not, it's a love that it's not hurting anybody, it's not offending anybody, you know. Mm. I mean, moral wise, if it offends somebody, then it's their problem, you know. Nowadays, you can't be offended with homosexuality. And this story about these brothers, you know, you can't say, oh, they are not procreating. So that makes it easier for me to, you know, like to defend the film, to say they're not going to, you know, that no chicken is going to be born out of this relationship, because they say they...
No two-headed children,
whatever, you know.
Yeah, and I must admit, when I was watching it this morning, I was sort of sitting there and I actually did think to myself, it's along the lines of, well, they're gay, so does it matter if they're related or anything like that? And because, yeah, it's as you said, they're not going to procreate. It's not like, say in Australia, where you can look back when I was in high school, there was the whole Virginia Andrews at Flowers in the Attic, which was all the similar sort of thing, but that all went a bit sour because the children ended up a bit strange and everything. Whereas this is, I just took this as you said, to be a love story. And the other things I took out from it that were what we were touching on before was, definitely wasn't judgmental. Like when the mother's watching them through the blinds at the hospital, you can tell she knows, in as a mother often does, what's going on. Not only on two levels, there is the gay level and the brotherly love level, and just the way she approaches it, of looking at it from, if ever there's anything you want to talk about, just talk. I'm not good. She didn't sit there and say, oh, you can't be this, you can't be that. It was all just very non-judgmental, which is what I really liked about the film.
Yeah. In that scene when the mother look at them, you know, through the window in the hospital, when she looks at them, I asked the actress, she's a very good actress, Julia Lemons, and I think she plays a very convincing, you know, liberal mother.
Yeah.
And I asked her to say, listen, this shot, it's like as if you were reading the whole script to the end. You know what's going to happen, you know, as if you knew what's going to happen with them. And it's about also about respect, you know. It's about family. It's about respect. It's not about. It's not that the mother and the family, they accepted the fact that they were homosexuals and they had an affair. They respected it. What else should a parent do? You know. I mean, if they're not hurting anybody, they're not hurting themselves. They're not hurting anybody. They're not just. So it's about respect as well. And I think she's a. You know, and she talked to the children, yeah. Right? She asked the...
We're speaking with Aloisio Abranches, the director of From Beginning to End. Can you stick around? We're going to just pause for a moment, and then we'd love to keep talking to you about your film and some of the issues it has raised.
Sure.
You're with Byron and Thomas here on The Casting Couch. What do we got coming up now, Byron?
We've got coming up Rule the World by Take That, and that was in the film Stardust.
You're listening to Joy 94.9.
You lie.
We're back on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Byron, and we are speaking with Aloisio Abranches, the writer and the director of From Beginning to End. How has the audience responded to your film, both in your own country of Brazil and other parts of the world where it has screened?
This is the sort of the world premiere of the film, international world premiere of the film. It's happening now here in Melbourne.
Okay.
And it's opening in France in May and whatever. It's opening. It's being released internationally in the next few months. But in Brazil, the film, the audience, it's split, you know.
Yeah.
The film, it was, we had quite a good number of spectators, you know. It was a small release, 12 prints, but it made, up to this moment, it's been playing for 4.5 months, and it made like 100,000 viewers, which is good for 12 prints.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of split. Either people like it very much or they don't like it. There are very few people who go, I don't know. But either you like it or they don't like it. The reason people don't like it, it's when they don't like it, it's because they think there's no conflict, which is for me, it's wrong. I think there is conflict in the, film. There is a sort of melancholy, you know, I mean, in the family, especially the mother. Not that, you know, that not that she's worried because she doesn't know how the world is going to treat them. It's not nothing to do with prejudice or because of their sexual preference, but because she knows it's difficult. You know, it's a difficult, you know. But so people think it's a bit too Doris Day, you know, type of film, type of story. And people who like it, they like it exactly for the same reason, you know, because they the way the film, you know, the way I treated the issues, the subject. There is a funny thing that there was a poll made in Brazil with the viewers, and most of the people who liked the film very much were women, like middle-aged women from 40 to 60.
Right.
Mothers.
The mothers liked it. Yeah.
The mothers liked it.
Well, the mother character is a beautiful character in the film.
It is. And it's just, you know, a wonderful actress. And maybe because of that, you know, that's a new thing that you're bringing.
You were talking a moment ago about the whole Doris Day look and feel to it. And I got... When I was watching it, I did notice that it's a film that's sort of bursting with colour, and it's got a particular sensibility. And I suspect it's both to do with reflecting the vibrancy of the part of the world you are from, but also referencing the classic melodramas of directors such as Douglas Sirk, and even more recently Pedro Almodovar, were the two directors that sprung to my mind. Am I on the right track here? Are these influences?
Well, that's no. Well, no. Yes,
you can say
the answer is yes. It's very flattering to hear that. Thank you. Because when I went to film school, I had a teacher in English. I went to film school in London, and I had one of my teachers, and he was like 120, and he told me that I had a sort of Douglas Sirk style. And I looked at him. I was like 22. I said, "What are you talking about? I don't know."
That Douglas Sirk is not cool in your early 20s.
No, it was. But I mean, I couldn't imagine myself doing. It's being a bit more serious now. That was sort of, I did it on purpose, you know. I wanted it to be had that kind of flirt with Hollywood.
Yeah.
Because actually, I had a friend, the director of photography. Is a Swiss guy called Uli Steiger, based in Los Angeles. He did Godzilla. He did a lot of, you know, big films. All the Roland Emmerich films, and The Day After Tomorrow, 2000 BC or 2000 whatever.
Yeah, and the last one's 2012. Yeah,
he didn't do this one because he went to
because you got him.
I got him, yeah.
You got him away from Hollywood, away from Roland Emmerich. Good work.
So there is this kind of... And I wanted it to be beautiful because I said, I want to tell a beautiful story, you know. I want to be sort of beautiful. I want it to be open. I want it to be sunny. It should go... You know, a film should always go in the same... Everything should go in the same direction, you know. If you talk about love and about... You want to talk about, you know, a love story in a... You know, happy love story. So it should be, in my view, like sunny and sort of beautiful.
Well, it's the other side of the coin to films like David Cronenberg's Dead Ringers or Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures. We were both films I thought of, and then I realized how different your film is to those two films.
Yeah, somehow I wanted, it's a moment, it's my moment that I wanted to do something like that. And for me, that's a very personal, you know, view of, but for me, I was very happy that I am in this moment now, and I talked about these subjects that I was due to talk sometime in my career. At this moment, so I treated these subjects this way. I'm glad with myself that I did it this way. I know that some people, you know, criticize it, and that's the film I wanted to make.
Fantastic. And just finally, I'm just curious to know, with the casting of the child actors who played the younger versions of Thomas and Chisco in the film. Were there any difficulties with the parents in getting them to cast those characters?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The older brother, Francisco, played by Lucas Cotrim, he's going to be a very good actor, I think.
Mm. They're both very strong.
They're both. But Lucas read the whole script. He discussed it. He was 12 when he did the film. Now he's 13 to 14. And we discussed the subject that we rehearsed. And the other one, he knew that they were going to have an affair. I don't know if he knows exactly. Mm. I think they do. I think I knew pretty much when I was 5. What? But
we don't give children enough credit sometimes, do we?
Yeah, you don't. The parents knew, of course, they told him. But we didn't rehearse. We rehearsed every morning. Every morning that he was shooting, we rehearsed for half an hour. I didn't give him the script to read, of course, but he knew everything about the film. They both knew, and it was not difficult. Not with them, and not with the parents. That was very clear from the beginning.
Well, you've achieved a lot of very natural performances in this film. Now, from beginning to end, is screening at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. The screening on Thursday, the 25th of March, has sold out. But this is pretty good. An extra session on Monday, the 29th of March, has been added. But I gather that tickets for that are already selling really, really fast. So, if you want to see this film, people, you want to get in quick. We'll put the link up on our Facebook page to where you can buy tickets for From Beginning to End. We've been speaking with Aluzio Abranche. He's the writer and the director of From Beginning to End, who is from Brazil and is in Melbourne as a guest of the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, absolute pleasure to speak with you. Byron, let's have one more song.
Yes, but all right, Alan shall throw on Release the Pressure.
Yep.
It's by Left Field from Judge Dredd.
You're on Joy 94.9. You're back on the casting couch on Joy 94.9. We're Thomas and Byron. We're almost out of here. Congratulations to Rod from St Kilda East. He's won the double pass to the Big Gay Musical, which is on Friday, 27th of March, 6:15 at Acme, courtesy of our very good friends at MQFF. Thank you very much to Murray today for taking care of the news. Big thank you to Maureen for coming in to review a film for us, and Warren as well for doing that. It's wonderful, kind of the ensemble that we've got built up now with the casting couch. Byron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For co-hosting, and I'm thrilled that you and Maureen will be sharing the microphones next week while both Kylie and I are slacking off.
Yes, no, it's going to be fun.
Alan, our producer and panellist, thank you as always. And a massive thank you to
Aloizio Abranches.
Thank you, Byron, for doing a magnificent interview and being very kind whenever I screwed his name up. He was a great interview too,
yes,
wasn't he?
Yes, no, very good.
Fascinating man and an interesting film. I'd be curious to hear what our listeners think of that after seeing it. Quickly, some correspondence I didn't get through before. Greg said, I saw Eating Out last night. What a laugh. Spelled L-A-R-F. Good on you, Greg. And also, we were talking about the recent senator who's been outed. And someone has informed us it is Republican Senator Roy Ashburn.
In California.
So outraged the film that deals with that sort of thing. Whew. Okay, time to get out of here. Come back next week to hear Byron and Maureen. A Touch of Pink with Dennis and Dick is coming up next on Joy 94.9. This has been The Casting Couch. Good night.
Yes, good night. And we'll see you out with If I Can't Dance by Sophie Ellis Bextor that was in the Centrinians film. If I can't dance, if I can't
dance, oh baby. Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.